All right, so it's 10 o'clock, so I think we should get started. I feel like I should have like a little bell or something to get people's attention. Yeah, there we go.
All right, kids, settle down. Settle down. I know we had a very exciting morning.
Thank you, Valerie. This is very helpful. So thank you all for being here. This is really cool to see an almost full room of folks interested in rural reporting. Yes. Okay. How's this? Is that better? Okay. You didn't miss anything. I was just saying it's really nice to see an almost full room of people interested in rural reporting and environmental journalism. Is the sound still bad, or how's the sound? Good? Good. So we have a full panel here of folks who are really experts in this, and I wonder if we should close those doors. Hey, Sarah, yeah, thank you. So next to me, I have Jen Byers, who is a visual and investigative independent journalist who's reported from places like Standing Rock, the Navajo Nation, Mauna Kea, rural Colorado, and Washington, D.C. They just completed a Selden Ring investigative fellowship at USC, so good to have you here, Jen. Next to Jen is Shreya Agarwal. Shreya is a climate journalist currently working at the USC Annenberg Center for Climate Journalism and Communications as their engagement coordinator. She was the center's first rural climate reporting fellow at Malheur Enterprise in Vail, Oregon. So also very good to have you here, Shreya. She was also kind of my co-conspirator in this panel, so it's nice to see her in person. And then we have Valerie Vandepan, who is the former managing editor of Native News Online and editor-in-chief of Tribal Business News. Much of Vandepan's work covers indigenous restoration and reconciliation, economics, smart urban planning, media, the environment, and politics. So also good to have you here. And I'm going to catch my breath for a second. This is the problem with doing long introductions, is that you lose your breath. So, okay. There we go. And then the last person on our panel here is someone who I work with very closely, Tim Merrima, who is the editor of the Daily Yonder, a national rural newsroom that's part of the nonprofit organization Center for Rural Strategies. He has a background in weekly and daily newspapers and helped launch the Daily Yonder in 2007. And we work closely together because I also work for the Daily Yonder as their environmental reporter. So Tim is often the first eyes on all of my first drafts. So thank you for that sacrifice. But I'm very excited to have you all here again. Okay, let me just work with this microphone. So I think the first bit of this panel is going to be discussion about what rural reporting really is, the importance of it in environmental journalism. As environmental journalists, we are all probably engaging with rural communities, whether we know it or not. So we want to talk about how we can kind of more fairly represent those rural people and places, and some of the pitfalls in media that we've seen, and ways we can do that reporting better. And then the last part, we're going to do some audience Q&A, and there will be some reminders then, but we can get to that when we do the Q&A. But I think I want to stop talking because I keep getting really out of breath, but the first question I have for all of you, and anyone can take this question, so please feel free to talk, is what is rural reporting and how does it intersect with environmental reporting? I mean, why are we all here today? I want to hear your guys' thoughts on that. Move this way.
Why is everyone looking at me?
Well, we're all in. I can't see anybody, so I'm just going to stand up here. Can you all see me now? Everyone's like cranking. I feel like I need to stand on my chair. My name is Valerie Vandepan, for those who didn't see me earlier. We're all in this room because we're all interested in rural reporting, right? How many people have been in rural America or live in rural America now? All right, so y'all know what rural reporting is. Does anyone in here not know why or what rural reporting is? I don't want to speak to what everyone is already kind of on the same page about. How many people actively cover the environment in a rural space? Okay, so that's almost everybody again. How many people genuinely care about the earth, the water, and the air that they breathe in their rural environment? All right, that was less hands for some reason. I don't know what that's about. All right, and how many people are really finding issues and conflicts and struggles and barriers in the work that they're doing? All right, that's everybody. So in the interest of getting to the meat and gritty of things, do you mind?
Go for it, please.
I want to hear what your struggles are. Can someone just like, we could do a popcorn style, yeah. Got it. How many people have a really difficult time finding sources and getting connected? Okay, great. So let's start there.
Yeah.
Okay. I will say, just since I'm still standing and holding the mic, that in my experience covering rural communities, reporters have a really shitty reputation. And I know I'm swearing, but I think we can all handle that. We're all grown-ups. We do. And there's a reason we do. It's because our colleagues helicopter into a place and then they helicopter out. And when you are in a place, it's your place. You are intimately connected to that place. So as reporters who are often on deadlines, rarely leave the office, are stuck in front of a screen, mining sources on social media, that's not connection. It's not real. You have to be in the community. You have to go to high school basketball games. You have to go to high school football games. You have to go to the water department. And you have to go to community center meetings. And you have to be there. And you have to listen and shut up. And you have to hold someone's hand while they cry because they just are working three jobs and they have no clean water and they're waiting for another water bottle delivery. It sucks. But that's how you make connections. And that's how you get referred to other people, and that's how you build trust, is you sit and listen. And you also share of yourself. Journalism ethics say that's not appropriate, but I say that's bullshit. You have to share of yourself. If that means going to a rural community that has no water, with a truck full of water and giving it away, with no expectation of people talking to you, that's what you do. Because you're a human and they're human and they need water. Something very, very basic. So that is my two cents starting us off. And I will pass the mic to my left.
I completely resonate with everything that Valerie said. And I would like to add, I think sometimes we end up like in this job just going through the motion and not realizing why we're doing it. I mean, take a second to think about why you became a journalist. For me, it was I want to take care of the planet. I want to take care of my people. I want to take care of my communities. And if you end up like, you know, going to a place, doing a story, coming out of it, maybe like there's always like some people who don't like your story. But if your community's not happy with your story, did you really do your job? Even if you got a story published, is it really worth it? And I mean, I was one of those people who had never, I grew up in cities. I had never reported on a rural community before I went to Oregon. And Valerie was actually one of the people I talked to before I ended up there. She gave me lots of advice. But when I was there, I realized I had no way to really understand what, you know, people's experiences were like until I actually, you know, went to all these different community events, until I went to all these different places where I could, you know, their local museum or the local shops, just like talking to people, trying to understand their lives. And I realized it's less about the journalism. It's, in the end, it's more about like, are you making a connection with the people? Because if people don't trust you, they're not going to trust your reporting. They're not going to trust your journalism. And then whatever you're doing, are you really making a difference? So, you know, I was one of those people who kind of helicoptered in, helicoptered out. I was there for only 2 months. I wish I could have stayed longer, but, you know, my entire experience was just, I did less climate. I probably published like 2 climate stories the entire time I was there. I asked my editor, can I cover more community events? Can you let me do that? I probably did like 15 community stories and like 2 climate stories. But at the end of the day, what really happened was I made a connection with the people there. They trusted me. When I walked into a room, they were like, hey, happy to see you. Because like you come in, you show up, and as Valerie said, you don't talk, you just listen, you let them talk. And I tried that and it worked because the people trusted me, and the few climate stories that I did publish, I got readership. People actually listened to what I had to say. And so I think I just wanted to second what Valerie said about, you know, just listening to the community, because you're doing the stories, you're publishing the stories for the community. It's not just about getting another byline.
I want to cut in here because we're talking about something that is often, people often talk about kind of the pitfalls in media when there's a reporter who's not familiar with the community helicoptering in like that. And I think in a lot of places, I mean, especially local newsrooms where you kind of, you do have the privilege to go to the basketball games, go to the community meetings. I mean, in rural America, local newsrooms have really been stripped or they don't exist anymore. So more and more you're seeing national newsrooms having to come in and or state newsrooms come in and do some of that work. You really can't do it all if you don't have a reporter who lives in that community, but you can do a little bit. And I'm wondering if any of you have thoughts on how you can be a reporter who is maybe not from that community. And I think Tim and then maybe Jen might have thoughts on this, because Tim, right, so Tim, this is a national newsroom that you're from, but you do a lot of those more local stories. So how can reporters do that work better?
Thank you, Claire. We are national. We often get put with local news. Oh, we'll put the Daily Yonder with local news, but we're not really local because we're focused nationally, but we do have a geographic footprint on rural America, so we're kind of betwixt and between. Our background at the Center for Rural Strategies is as a nonprofit communications organization, and what we try at the Daily Yonder to do is to identify there will be some kind of nonprofit infrastructure within most rural communities. Often it could be a community development corporation like a housing group or an economic development group. And they're going to know everybody in the community. And if you can find somebody who will be your quote-unquote fixer and introduce you, then their credibility and their reputation, which you have to protect, comes along with you. That's one way we do it. And we try to find someone to speak to us who is accountable to that community in some way, so that we're not going in and finding the three voices on one side of an issue and there's a much broader discussion going on that we didn't hit because they are not accountable to the community. So I'd say start. You can also most so church denominations are going to have, like the Presbyterian Church has a presbytery. You could ask somebody in a denomination structure, who's somebody I could talk to in that community. United Methodist Church, those are in a lot of places, Southern Baptists, etc. And so it's not as easy as finding that voice. You got to find the voice who finds the voice for you, which is something reporters do all the time. So,
Jen, did you have thoughts on this? Yeah.
So a little bit about my background. My mom's family is from here. They're from West Philadelphia and Southwest Philadelphia. My dad's family is from the South. So I grew up with the media talking about the communities that my family was from as, you know, idiots, as, you know, poor folks in areas that, you know, we're uneducated or we're different or we're somehow less than human. So I became a reporter kind of in 2015, 2016, when I saw that kind of under you know, the rise of Trump, not only was the danger of Trump not being meaningfully covered, but also his supporters were being, like, so demonized and dehumanized in ways that pushed folks closer to him, right? So that kind of started me. I started doing political journalism and then citizen journalism, and then I ended up at Standing Rock, where I was this, like, redhead little Irish girl in the middle of North Dakota. Like, what the hell am I doing? But one of the things that kind of endeared people to me was the skepticism that I shared of the media. And so I was working at the media tent up there with Indigenous Environmental Network, and it was really interesting because I was living at the camp. So I was, like, immersed in a number of different cultures. There were cultures from all around the world that had come up there. And then there were these parachuting reporters that were coming in that maybe had 3 days to get to know something that was being described on the ground as a war, right? And they were, it's a protest. You guys are activists. What's going on? And there was this immediate class divide. There was this immediate cultural divide. There was this immediate dissonance in the reality of the danger. And how do I say this? I have found that understanding those differences has been able to inform, like, the rest of my reporting for the rest of my life, right? Because what is one of the primary differences between newsroom culture and rural culture? A lot of it is class, right? Because when you're in rural environments, you're going to be around all ethnicities. You're going to be around immigrants. You're going to be around Indigenous folks. You're going to be around settlers. You're going to be around a lot of different communities, just like you would be in the city. But there's a major class divide often. And that is something that we do not want to talk about as journalists, and we do not want to talk about how journalism has pretty consistently served folks who are of a certain class, of a certain education level. And instead of acknowledging those differences or maybe bringing in reporters who are not so acculturated to certain class, you know, class assimilations, reporters tend to come into communities and look down on them. And so I find that I've had to report. So I worked for Al Jazeera for a while, and a lot of my reporting that I did was from Al Jazeera. So I was at a time in my career where I had a 1 week long deadline, and I had to figure out how can I come into a community safely and respectfully, knowing what I knew about those divides, those differences, the discomfort. And so, kind of like Tim said, I always worked with folks from the community. So when we did video journalism, I always would hire a videographer from the community. So then you could literally see the community from their eyes, right? In camera-based work, it's a little bit maybe easier than print because there's a very literal visual component to it, right? For one story, for example, that I did on Mauna Kea, I kind of talk about this story in particular as, like, a solid recipe, right? Where I had spent time in Hawaii. I had a lot of connections there just from knowing different water protectors and land defenders. But I was able to hire a Hawaiian VJ who was not affiliated with the Mauna Kea struggle. So he had kind of coming in an awareness, obviously, of Hawaiian culture, kind of an awareness of the history. But he was like a surf videographer. He was like an adventure sport videographer, so he really didn't have anything to do with the conflict at the time. And we had this really wonderful reciprocal relationship where I was, like, filling him in on a lot of, like, the political stuff, and he was filling me in on a lot of the cultural stuff. And between my access to the sort of, like, land defenders, activists, kind of, you know, the protectors, but his access to kind of, like, the grandmas and the folks that kind of, you know, that maybe were showing up to this fight but didn't necessarily show up to every fight, we were able to produce work that, you know, got pretty singular access. So I think a lot of the times, like, working, I mean, like, you must work with the community, and you also must have prior connections if you're a national reporter, if you're an international reporter, if you have to be doing that jumping in. Networks of people exists, right? You know, people, not all rural people are confined to their space. There are plenty and plenty and plenty of folks that travel nationally, that are engaged in national struggles, that are based in rural areas. And I think plugging into that network can be a really healthy way to engage on a tight deadline. But also building up that source book takes so much groundwork, and that's enough. So yeah.
I just want to say that, Jen, you said that so well.
And I'm really happy she pointed out the issue of class. That's amazing. And also the issue of Trump. And that analysis that she gave of, or they gave, excuse me, that they gave of the coverage of Trump supporters pushing them further into Trump is astute. And that analysis is nowhere in mainstream media right now. And yet it continues to resonate.
Well, that, yeah. I'm really glad that you, about everything you just mentioned, but you're speaking to the integral thing I want all of you to go away from this panel with, which is that rural America is not just a monolith of angry white people. There's a lot of discussion right now about rural resentment, and that's kind of since Trump, there's been this depiction of rural America as just this monolithic swath of angry white Republicans. But that is a very narrow depiction of who rural America is. And that kind of gets to one of the questions I wanted to ask you all, which is if you can talk about how to include more diverse voices in your rural reporting, because, if you want to better represent rural America, you have to talk to diverse folks. But how do you make those connections, especially in rural places where there is more distrust in the media? I think it, and we've been sort of getting at that relationship building, but I wanted to see if any of you have specific ways that have been successful for including more diverse voices in your reporting.
I think for me, it comes down to knowing the community that you're going into. And I'll give you an example. It's not rural, but I think it paints the appropriate picture. In 2014, the New York Times, is anyone here from the Times? Okay. In 2014, the New York Times ran a story about Detroit's comeback. It was multiple pages, multiple photos, just Detroit's this glorious, safe place now with great food and all this wonderful stuff. Detroit is 83% African American. The next largest population is Arab American, then Mexican American, and finally white people are the vast, by far margin, the minority in Detroit. The New York Times article only interviewed white people, went to white businesses, and had pictures of white people. That's it. And at the time I was at the Metro Times in Detroit, which is an alt-weekly, we called them out for it. About a week after of us badgering and badgering and badgering them, they apologized for the story. If you go to a place in, for example, rural Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Arkansas, Texas, and you're only talking to white people, you're probably missing a story. Same thing with Ohio, Michigan. If you're only talking to white people, you're missing a story. Because there are huge populations of Arab Americans, Asian Americans, Black Americans, Native Americans, everyone that's hyphenated except for white folks. And in order to do that effectively, you as a reporter have to have some awareness of what you're doing and where you're going. I just had someone from rural Ohio. They're starting a rural newsroom in Ohio. Is anyone here from Ohio? Great. So they have this new publication, and it's all this stuff about what's happening. And they have one of the largest mosques in Ohio in their community. And they have no idea how to work with or talk with or communicate with the Arab Americans there. And all the Arab Americans speak English. They all have businesses. they're there, they're in schools. And the fear, I think, you know, I had someone just last week tell me that he was really afraid of the migrants coming into the country. And I asked him why. And he said, well, I don't speak their language, and I'm afraid they won't understand me. And I thought that was really interesting, because he was afraid that the people coming in, he couldn't communicate with them. The people that are already here are waiting. They want to be communicated with. But if you're afraid or don't know how, that's going to be a huge barrier. So I don't know what that work looks like for each person in here. It's different for everybody. But it's personal work that has to be done. And no one can do that for you. And I'm just going to say one more thing about that. Because I was hired to work at an NPR member station for a year. And when I got to that station, which is in a predominantly wealthy white area, there was a man who'd been at the station for 40 years, very popular on-air personality. When I got there to this area, the president of the local NAACP chapter invited me, welcomed me. He was like, I want to meet up with you. I want to show you around. Great. This 40-year veteran of the NPR station was like, can I come? I'm like, what do you mean? Like, you don't know this guy? How can you not know? He's like, no, but I don't even know where the black people live. He'd been in this community for 40 years. He didn't even know where the black folks lived. And this is at NPR. So when a person of color does come into your newsroom, they owe you nothing. They do not owe you a tour of the black neighborhood or a tour of the res or any open doors. They owe you their good journalistic reporting. But if you're in a community and you know there's black people around but you don't know where they live, you have work to do. And you have to do that yourself.
Thank you, Valerie. And yeah, Sherry, do you want to talk about anything? I mean, especially, I'm also very interested in your experience in rural Eastern Oregon, which I will say is a very white space. So I am curious what it was like going there. And because this also goes the other way. While rural America is diverse, it is whiter than a lot of cities. So I am curious how you navigate that.
I'll be honest, I was scared before I was going to go there because I am a woman of color. I'm small, so, you know, I was scared of all the guns that I might encounter, just fears. And people gave me advice. They were like, you know, don't go out anywhere when it's dark. Don't go in places where, you know, you could be in trouble. And when I got there, I realized people were so much more open to me being there than I ever thought they could be. And they saw me more as a person than people do in cities sometimes, which really warmed my heart. And it made me open up to them more than I thought I would. And, you know, before I went there, I was like, okay, I'm going to do this for 2 months, get my stories done, get out, because people there are not going to connect to me. And it was literally the opposite, what I encountered. And that really changed my perspective on what rural America looks like, in the sense of people really care about their communities because their communities are everything. I mean, in our cities, we're connected with so many different things. The world really seems smaller, and so we don't have enough time for people. But that's really not the case in smaller communities where, like, community is everything for them. And especially in Eastern Oregon, a lot of people don't know this, but it's always been a very multiracial, diverse place just because well, the history is not that great, but, you know, there was a lot of Japanese encampments during the Second World War that were located near that area, and that, brought in a lot of Japanese folks into the area. And, of course, it's, like, a really terrible way to, like, include diversity, but then people got, you know, people connected with each other after the war was over, after the encampments were shut. And, you know, the people ended up staying there. A lot of Japanese folks ended up staying there. And a lot of connections that I made was with the Idaho-Oregon Buddhist Temple. And they were some of the friendliest folks out there. I mean, they made this entire community. And so people there are really used to seeing, you know, people of like even the white people are used to seeing people of color. They see a lot of Mexican immigrants who come there to work in the farms, and they're connected with them. They're connected with the Japanese folks. So there is diversity, and we often don't acknowledge that when we talk about even the Trump supporting part, which like Malheur County, where I worked, was 75% Trump supporters. But people don't acknowledge that, you know, there could be diversity even within those Trump supporters. They were not racist. Like, I can tell you that for a fact. Even though they supported Trump, those people that I met there, not a single person that I spoke to, at least not a single white person that I spoke to, was a racist. So we need to acknowledge that not every single white Trump supporter also looks the same. And I mean, that can often like be a barrier, because that was a barrier for me before I went there. I thought, you know, people will see me as, you know, a woman of color, an Indian person, just, you know, I don't belong there. But no one treated me like that. Not a single person.
That's really great to hear. So you reminded me of something I also wanted to get to today. And it's something I've thought of before getting into environmental journalism, but working at a lot of environmental nonprofits that were located in cities. And there's often a disconnect between conservationists or environmentalists and rural communities. There can be a tension there because there's a history of folks coming in and saying that, you know, there, I feel like ranchers, this is an example that comes to mind for me. There is distrust there because there's concern that, you know, they're going to stop rural folks from, you know, doing their business or coming in and saying that they are the expert on that environment, even though they don't live in that environment, basically. And I think that that can often play out in environmental journalism, where the experts that you talk to, a lot of the time the experts in that environment are going to be the people who have lived in that environment for a very long time, lived and worked in that environment, even if they don't have necessarily the PhD or the credential that proves that. And I was hoping, I mean, Jen, you might have thoughts on this with the kind of work that you've done with a lot of going into communities where there's been mining, for example, especially working with indigenous communities. But how do you treat your sources? How do you find sources who are working in that environment, and how do you talk to them? I mean, how do you avoid falling into the pit of, I can only talk to a person from XYZ organization because they have the credential that proves to my readers that what they're saying is correct? I mean, how do you do that?
Gosh. Okay, on the spot. Okay, ooh, that's a really good question. Okay, so wandering, you got to wander. You know, you gotta drive around, you gotta walk around, you gotta go into stops, you gotta talk to everybody, you gotta talk to the lady at the diner, you gotta talk to the lady at the Dollar General, you gotta talk to the guy at the tourist shop. You know, one of the things like about rural communities, like they tend to be little sites of ecosystem, right? Everybody goes into town, right? Everyone goes to the hot springs, everyone goes this, that, the other. And if you can kind of understand how like the geographic area functions, you can kind of figure out where to meet people. And when you're meeting people, you have to kind of like look like someone they're going to want to talk to. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. There's a couple strategies to do that, right? There's the like, I'm going to dress like the community, which only works if you can pull it off, right? You know, don't throw on cargo pants and a t-shirt if you're used to wearing Patagonia. You know, don't, you know what I mean? You know, don't show, hi, fellow kids, how y'all doing? No, don't do that. If you're not from an area, you can also like lean into that. You know, I kind of go between like West Philly and, you know, I was just in rural Ontario last weekend. And, sometimes I'll lean into looking different because that will like, oh, look, this rare bird's here. What are they doing? You know, and that'll engender a level of curiosity. But I think kind of when either of these, in whatever profile you create, right, you want to look, authentic, and you want to look yourself, and you want to find how can I represent myself in a way that is going to quickly get me access in a true and authentic way. So, for example, I had to do a story in rural Colorado, and I'd never been there before, but I was, you know, familiar in general with the Southwest. So when I got there, I went to the national park. I kind of talked to, you know, the BLM folks. I talked to the national park folks. I talked to some of the tourists. Then I went to kind of like followed basically like the public route. Like I went to the touristy part of town. I talked to the shopkeeper. You know, I finally found a shopkeeper that was friendly. He kind of made me get, you know, pointed me in the, towards the more local direction. Then you kind of basically follow the train that way. I don't know. Does that make any sense? But it all kind of starts from like knowing yourself and not trying to be pretentious, not trying to be rude, but just trying to be really curious. Because I think one of the things that I've found is that the bullshit meter in rural communities is like really high. Like people are going to know if you're full of shit, you know. And so, how can you show up to a space that maybe you've never been to without being full of shit? And that does take a lot of self-awareness. That does take a lot of self-knowledge. That does take a lot of self-reflection, which maybe as journalists, we're not always like encouraged to do. You know, there's this idea in journalism that you have to be this objective, fixed outsider that kind of comes into a community and, you know, shows the truth of it. But if you kind of look at the origin of that ideology, again, it comes from a very specific academic lineage. It comes from very specific cultural lineage. And it's had very specific material impacts on the world through colonialism, through manifest destiny, through white saviorism. And so I think also part of this, part of the answer to this question is about understanding the ideologies behind journalism and how they have impacted the way that the industry expects us to show up, expects us to look, expects us to act. And then asking yourself, how can I do my job effectively without perpetuating the harms or the biases that actually deeply, deeply, deeply exist in our profession? You know, another thing, when you go into rural environments and you're trying to talk to people, your understanding of time is probably going to have to change. You know, I've worked so many times. I've been somewhere and it's not meet me at 7 o'clock. It's meet me at sundown, you know, and yeah, so it's about, you got to change how you think a little bit. But yeah, sorry.
No. I would also like to add, you need to believe that you can connect with everyone. Like, you know, there's always something you have in common with everybody. Like there was one time when I walked into this museum and there was only one museum in the small town because there was only like 1,000 people who lived there. And I walked in there and I was just like browsing around, and the woman who ran the museum, Betty, she basically, we just started talking about like these old artifacts, and suddenly she goes like, oh, these people from DC come in and tell us how to like manage our land, even though like we've been here for 100 years, and like they have no idea. And I'm like, I get tired too, because like some of the things they're doing are completely incorrect, and that's how I managed to like connect with her. And then we like started talking about hiking and what we loved about it. So like, you know, there was this person, and she's not a Democrat. She is not progressive, and we didn't need to bring that up. We didn't need to talk about that. We needed to talk about what we had in common, and we go from there. So like, I think that's like another way to like connect with people, because she's lived there for like 60 years. She knows how the land looks like. She knows what the land looks like. So I think, you know, you just start talking to people and just listen to them. Really listen to them. Listen to what they're trying to say to you. And don't bring your own biases in when you're listening to them, because sometimes even though they have different opinions, they might offer you something really insightful that you may have never thought about.
So I see we have some questions. I want to ask one more question, and then we're going to open it up for Q&A, because I'm really excited for your guys' questions. But I wanted to ask Tim, and this is something that I've been, I think it's a learning process, but there is some terminology that I will often see used when talking about a rural community, like isolated or remote. And I would love to hear your perspective on ways that are and are not helpful for describing a rural community in our reporting.
Thank you so much. Boy, that's a softball. But my least favorite word is Hamlet. And the New York Times likes that word a lot. I got to go down to the hamlet for some milk. I think to try to find what is the terminology that the community uses to describe itself. And interestingly, you know, I grew up in a very rural area, small town with a school in it, and the county seat had 500 people in it, and that was, you know, they looked down at us because we were the, you know, the hicks, and we looked down at other parts of the county, you know, so we, these layers upon layers upon layers that we can't assume that we know. And I think the danger when we come into a place is that we're taking where we're from and superimposing it. And they've got their own superimposing. So how do they describe it? I think terms like isolated and bedraggled, you know, there are. And it's like isolated according to whom? And this town, Canadian, Texas, which I heard the word isolated used for, it's in the panhandle. They don't think they're isolated. So how do people view themselves? And one way to get around this is also to describe, not tell. And you can use population figures. I'm happy. Anybody who shoots me an email, I'm happy to talk to you about or send data about how you could, what kind of rural is this? Is it frontier? Is it New England? And when we describe things, then we give people who live in other types of places that may have similarities and differences a chance to see where they might fit in how they can relate to that community.
So when I went to Oregon, I realized everyone, at least 75% of people who supported Trump, hated the word climate change, as we know. But they didn't hate the word climate variability. And I realized that when I started talking to them, and like this one fire chief was like, climate change doesn't exist, but the wildfire season's getting longer. And it's been like 4 or 5 months instead of the usual thing. So I realized they want specificity. I think everyone realizes that climate change is happening. They just don't want to use the words for it. And I'm like, I'm okay with not using the word climate change, as long as we can agree to something, which, again, everyone agrees that the fire season is getting longer. Everyone agrees that agriculture is getting affected. Everyone agrees that rain's been variable. If climate variability is the term you like, I will use that in all of my stories. I don't need to use the word climate change. I think the point is to get everyone to agree on the same vocabulary, whatever it is, and everyone to get, you know, agree on the same ideas. So I do agree. You need to really be in that community and see what they, you know, think, what they want to be, you know, what they want to call different kinds of things, what they want to call themselves.
Thank you, Shreya. And we're going to do question answers real fast.
Okay, just real quick is, yeah, that's absolutely right. Everyone wants clean water, clean air. Everybody. It doesn't, it's not bipartisan. It's not like a Republicans think this or Democrats think that. Everybody wants their kids to have clean water and clean air. And coming from that, whatever the environmental issue, it's almost, there's so much common ground. I learned that in Florida, which is very, very Republican. Everybody in Florida is very well versed on red tide and ocean pollution and plastic pollution. They all know. I mean, every Republican will talk your ear off about the importance of the environment there. So,
yeah. Okay, so we have about 30 minutes for questions and answers. So before we get started, I just want to remind folks kind of what they were reminding folks in the Michael Regan Q&A, which is no speechifying, so questions. And then if you could say your name and your affiliation, that would be great. But I'm staring at you, Manola, so go for it.
hi, my name is Manola
Zagaina.
I'm a reporter with the NPR Station, Talk Radio in Sacramento. I just wanted to say that I have so many questions, but I'll keep it short. And this one's for everyone. One thing that I think about sometimes is, you know, when I'm going into a community, especially one that I'm not part of, that's a rural community, I do find myself, you know, trying to connect with people and, like, chatting with people and then connecting with them on that personal level. But there's always that awkwardness for me sometimes of knowing
I'm Valerie Vandepan, and I'm a reporter working on a story about XYZ. Can you tell me more? Or, you know, are you comfortable telling me more? Are you comfortable? Well, it depends. I mean, if I'm in the diner eating and chatting with a waitress, and the waitress tells me, like, oh, that empty lot down there is the site of an old paint factory, and now they're putting a school on it, and it never got cleaned up, and the land was never remediated. Oh, to me, that's a story, and I'm going to ask more questions and probably not quote her, but follow up on the lead. So it depends on the context, but if you're specifically interviewing or asking for your story, you got to, in my opinion, you got to disclose when you introduce yourself if you're coming into the conversation wearing that hat. Adversarial?
Yeah, adversarial.
Are you at YSO?
Yeah.
I love YSO. I love Dayton. Yeah. Great community, great station too. You guys are awesome. One of the best in Ohio. Jen can take it.
I usually talk to leadership last. That's kind of my little hack with it. Is I'll first interview kind of like all the folks around, I'll do my surveying, I'll do everything, I'll collect as much data as I can. And then when I go to leadership, I'm about to tell y'all a secret, so don't tell them how I do this. I tend to get underestimated, right? I look younger than I am. I have a baby face. So I play dumb when I first come in. I'm like, oh, my God, hi, I love your community. It's so beautiful here. Yeah, you know, I'm from the city. This is so crazy, you know. So tell me. Like, what are you doing out here? Tell me about the new petroleum, whatever. And then they're going to give you their spiel. They're going to say, well, you know, we've opened up 18 new things, and we're doing this, and we're doing that. And you're like, oh, my God, that's crazy. Like, what science are you working with? And they're like, we have our own policy lab at, you know, bought off university. Like, this is what it's, you know, here's what it says. Here's the papers. I'm like, oh, my God, thank you so much. I haven't seen this before. I've never heard of these things. Oh, my goodness. And you kind of, like, play dumb, and you let them think that they are doing a PR campaign and that they are going to be the recipient of a glamour piece, basically. And then about midway through the interview, you drop your first hard question. And that way they're already trapped, right? They're already in the room with you. They're already on the record. They're already comfortable. Their lips are a little bit loose. And you can basically kind of vary through that, where you go between being kind of real friendly or playing what, again, knowing your profile, whatever your advantage is in that situation, right? A lot of people who are doing corruption are also very misogynistic, right? So they're going to think I'm dumb. Like, you know, like whatever. You can kind of play that harm to your advantage in a weird way. And then basically I kind of just go from a sort of like soft, like a real warm softball kind of silly approach to like a real hard question. And then I'll jump back and I'll be like, well, anyway, you know, I heard that fracking was bad. Like, do you think that's true? And they're like, well, it's not fracking. Fracking doesn't do anything. Da-da-da-da. You know, they give you their PR spiel. And then they'll say, you know, no science says. And I was like, okay, fine, then wastewater removal. Like, what about that? You know what I mean? Your knowledge of the science and your knowledge of the research and your knowledge of everything is going to be your biggest friend. Because a lot of the folk times when you do accountability reporting, they have prepackaged answers to dodge the real thing that you're trying to get at. And the more specific you are with the language, the more specific that you are with what is actually happening, the more incisive your questions can be. So again, it's kind of like it's a little bit martial arts, right? It's like, do, like, then you go in. And one of the things that can be really fun about this style of interviewing is sometimes they lose it. Like, they absolutely lose it. And then you have them losing it on the record. And that's real fun to work with. So, yeah, that's kind of how I do it. But, yeah, don't let this, like, don't tell them, right? Please don't tell them.
All right, more questions. In the back, pink hair. Yes.
Well, as for some, you know, the difference between I voted this way and I'm an active participant in an organization that foments, you know, white supremacy and against equality and civil rights, you know, that's... I don't know... I can't tell who that person is when I'm talking to them or by looking at them. So I'm not sure how, if there is an active organization in the community, that's one thing. If you assume it's there, that's another. And I, you know, absolutely there are racists in rural America. And, you know, Archie Bunker was in Queens. So I don't know. I'm not able to answer the question, I guess, because I'm not sure. Are you saying giving people a pass on things or? Oh. Yeah. I'll say one thing that when you talk to people about values, you get a set of answers that are very different than if you talk to them about party affiliation, and if you talk about the Democrats' plan to ABC, and you can, and it's, we've done this AB testing, and you give them the same policy recommendation without a party affiliation, the numbers change dramatically. So avoiding, so the labeling that gets put on any group, but rural is susceptible to it, especially around the partisanship, because we only get to vote for one person. You don't get to vote for racism, anti-racism. You got to vote for the person.
Here, let's just do like one more minute of answering this question, okay. And we'll keep.
I'm just going to say that I know Oregon has some very concrete examples of very active white supremacist groups. That said, when I worked in both Detroit and Boston, every year there was some group of Nazis that would get together and they would march in public. And it was always like 12 guys who, like, that was their one outing a year. And all the other stations and papers and stuff would cover these 12 guys. And as an editor, I was always hard-lined, no. Because that's what they want. And there's no reason we need to uplift hate. So, I mean, that was my editorial discernment in two places where, again, it was 12 guys who did an annual march who crawled out of their parents' basements to do it. You know, that to me isn't news, you know? And there's no reason to uplift that. There's other and way more important things in those communities at that time that needed our attention.
Yeah, I can go real fast. Oh, okay. If you want to talk to me after, I have a lot of thoughts about this. But TLDR, I think specificity is super duper important. And when I said what I said about pushing voters closer, it's because, like, here's the one example. I literally had one of the bureau chiefs of the Wall Street Journal tell me that he thinks all Trump reporters are stupid. So my commentary was more about those swaths that we kind of see in, like, high level editorial, not the specific things, but I'd love to talk to you after. Yeah.
Okay, more questions. I saw your hand first.
So I had a similar experience to yours where my editor was the editor-in-chief of the paper, didn't have experience covering environment, and like that, I was pretty much the only person who knew what was going on at my newsroom. What I did was I was very strategic with what quotes I used from what people, because like sometimes when I was talking to certain scientists and like then talking to certain leaders, like, you know, the fire chief or whatever, things contradicted, right? Some people didn't get stuff right. So I made it my job to figure out what stuff they did get right and what they didn't. And then I used like my own, I guess, knowledge, my own information to like compile all the quotes together so that my story in the end turned out correct. Because like sometimes, like, you know, these people are working in so many different fields. It's not that they want to mislead you intentionally, but they just get stuff wrong. And so I guess like that's just a general climate reporting comment that, you know, people do get stuff wrong and you have to be the person who like makes sure things are right. So like even though I do want to make sure, like, you know, I don't want to, you know, remove a source from my story just because they said one thing wrong and let that be like, okay, they got this one thing wrong. They must be getting everything wrong, right? So you kind of have to use your own brain there and just be like, you know, I just want to make sure that this person's right about this thing, so I'll code them here and maybe not code them for the rest of the stuff. So that's kind of how I went about it. And you can always just talk to other reporters, other journalists, if you want more advice on this. Like maybe share your story with someone else and be like, hey, am I getting this right? Am I doing this right? Because that's what I did. I went back to where I work, USC, Annenberg Center for Climate Journalism and Communication. If I was not sure about something, I connected with them. Like in data journalism, we always say use a Sherpa, and so I think that's a really good advice for climate journalism too, just like always have a Sherpa to like guide you, because it is a really hard topic to cover with so many moving pieces at the same time.
Questions over here. Yeah.
My name is Celeste Gracia. I'm at the NPR station in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. just a very vague idea, and I don't know how to make it concrete. Mm-hmm. So how should I go about this? What do y'all think?
Do you know where they're planning to put the solar panels? Like, do you have maps, or do you have, like, any data for, like, where they're trying to put them? Yeah, I would go to go to the most public space in the surrounding community, right? Because, and then look at map data first, right? You know, are they trying to put it on, you know, not, you know, I know there's, like, for example, like, there's a reservation in Western North Carolina. Like, are they trying to put it right next door to the res? Are they trying to put it on land that's traditionally Black or traditionally Indigenous? Or, you know what I mean? Like, I would look first at where they're trying to put it and kind of see just through demographic trends and through, you know, histories, whose land they're trying to put it on, and then go from there. Because a lot of the times, I mean, they're still doing this with the green energy push. Like, Indigenous land is always, like, the first thing that they try to use. Or, you know, and even if it's not federally registered or specifically tribal land, it's still ancestral, it's still held, it's still allotment or whatever the specific jurisdiction is in your state. But I personally would start from there, is go to the most, like, look at the maps, find out where they are in the maps, see if you can find out any kind of demographic from that data. And then once you kind of figure the specific locations as much as possible, then go to the most public space in the region. So whatever that, you know, whatever that means to you. Usually places that are Main Street, you know, start there, or the church. Whether, you're only going to know the region better than me, but does that, anyone else? Sorry, does that help? Okay.
And I know you're far away from the stage of writing it, but when you do write it, make sure you don't frame it in a way that, you know, solar panels are bad just because this community is opposing it. Because, like, you know, oftentimes these communities can end up being misrepresented in the wrong way by, like, you know, if you, like, let's say if you say these people don't want solar panels, like, that may not be their only agenda, and that may just become the image of how we see these people. So, like, make sure you add that kind of balance. And I know you're far away from, like, that stage, but just wanted to make that clear.
Thank you. And great question. And what I've observed just from watching this issue over time is that there's a lot of reporting about pushback against wind and solar. And there's so much that I've wondered if there's a campaign about it that taps into natural resistance to change where I live. One of our reporters is from Kansas. He says, his mom says, the tallest things in a town should be the grain silo and the church steeple. And they've just ruined this. You know, she drives past the wind turbines, and it just bothers her a lot. I come from an energy sacrifice zone in central Appalachia that basically was written off. And we have a lot of resistance to energy companies through a century of exploitation. And so I don't automatically – and I think – I want to say – this green energy, this is for all of us. We're all going to benefit. But, you know, it generally it's a corporation. They are, you know, they're going to make money off it. And the costs of it will be externalized to people who do not benefit. Rural places don't necessarily get a lower energy bill because of the siting of renewable production there. So it's really, really complicated. And yet on the other side, you know, the science is clear that we've got to change how we produce energy. So I'm glad you asked this question, but I fear that we're getting that the discussion can get down to that point really quickly, and then it's just, you know, these are the NIMBYs and these are the people are trying to control my land, and it, that doesn't go anywhere. So how we frame it is really important. I don't have a great answer to that, but I think it's something we got to figure out. Yeah.
Okay. Let me see. Right in the middle, blue, long shirt. Yes, yeah, glasses. And this is hard, you guys. yes, yeah.
Mm.
One thought is that, so there are lots of different definitions of rural, more than a dozen within the federal government funding. The two primary ones are from the Office of Management and Budget, Metropolitan Statistical Areas. So you can look at, so these are ways, these are this is demographic information that isn't about race or economic status. But are they in a metropolitan statistical area? If not, it's non-metro, and we use that as a shorthand for rural a lot. The census also tracks, has a different definition that's within a county, and they'll tell you the percentage of people in that county who live in what they consider to be rural areas, which are non-urbanized. So those are a couple ways you can get at how, what kind of rural is this. There's also a... the Economic Research Service at USDA has a classification system of economic type, and there are recreation counties, energy dependent, agriculture, general, public entities like prisons or universities or so. So that's another way you can describe them. It's and I'm happy with anyone to just share the source for all of that stuff.
Okay, I think we have 5 minutes left, so maybe two more questions. And I saw your hand first. I'm so sorry to everyone who we don't get to.
My name is Elizabeth. I work for Harvest Public Media from Nebraska. I cover agriculture and rural communities. And something that I struggle with a lot in my reporting is balancing the people who are experiencing climate change and the people who are contributing to climate change being the same people. I'm from rural Nebraska, so I know that, like, I talk to a lot of farmers especially, and I know
I'll just briefly say that with climate change globally, the onus is not on the consumer. It's not your fault. It's not my fault. We're living in this colonial capitalism dystopian nightmare that is climate change. And you can recycle all you want, but we're not going to recycle our way out of this problem. And so when it comes to the farmers that have ag practices that are causing waterway problems in the community, if they're aware of that, then in my mind, okay, what are the solutions? How do we report on the solutions in the community, bringing that education, bringing those solutions, integrating them, like what's happening, how do you uplift that, how do you inform, how do you educate, what programs are going on, that kind of thing. So I don't think anyone intentionally poisons their own water. And also I've seen an entire town that had cancer because of coal fly ash. And the cattle that they were raising was eating the grass that was contaminated with coal fly ash. And they knew it. And they still sold their cattle at the sale barn because they needed to pay for their cancer treatment.
Thank you. We might have time for, like, two more questions. Oh, yes, sorry. Sure.
No. Valerie answered. You answered better than I would.
Okay, yeah, and I do want to get to some more questions here. Yes, yeah, Blue, yeah.
Has
take this real quick. So this is a common problem in Detroit. People in Detroit are always getting taxpayer dollars because they're promising jobs, but they don't have to deliver the jobs. So I think the easiest way at some point is to just point out that just because they're promising to bring 1,000 jobs, will they really bring 1,000 jobs? What are the repercussions if they don't? Will there be any repercussions if they don't? Besides the jobs that they're promising that they may or may not deliver, what else, you know, is the cost? Mm-hmm. Hold on.
I also think you have a responsibility to tell people that, hey, there's a tire factory coming, which we all know production of tires is not really good for the environment. Oftentimes, a lot of pollutants get released into the air. And even though, yes, it's important for people to have jobs, if people get sick, I think they need to know that there's a potential they can get sick. And so I think it's your responsibility to at least like point that out in some way or the other.
Absolutely. So I think we are at time here, but I'm going to assume we're all open to questions after this. So if you want to come up to us, please do. But again, just thank you all so much for your questions. Thank you, panelists, for your amazing thoughts and discussions. And please come talk to us.